Welcome to Outbeat Collage Out in the Arts. I'm Gary Carnevale. Thank you for listening this fine evening. Tonight, it's all about the movies. First, I'll chat with Chelsea Koenig, who is a film programmer for the Alexander Valley Film Festival. Later, a conversation with Jane Winslaw, the co-director and festival manager of the Sebastopol Documentary Film Festival. But up now, Greg Moralia with Outbeat Radio News.
Chief Magnus, while Dean of the Police Academy in Napa. I can tell you he's quite a remarkable leader, and one the Bay Area and our LGBT community can be proud of. And in Alabama, the family of Nigel Shelby announced last week they filed suit against the Huntsville City Schools for a civil rights violation and wrongful death. Shelby had only attended Huntsville High School for under a year when he took his own life on April 18, 2019. Nigel Shelby was bullied by his peers for his race and sexual orientation, and when he sought help from school administrators, he was told that his sexuality was a choice. School administrators did not alert Nigel's parents of his struggles in school so that they could get him help from a licensed mental health professional. Following his death, school administrators alerted Nigel's mother to look for a suicide note in his backpack, thus revealing that they were aware of his plans to take his own life. The district announced that it had been notified of pending litigation last month and didn't comment on the legal proceedings. They did want to remind students, families, and staff members of the longstanding resources in place to support students. They also tout a strong gay-straight alliance and partnership with GLSEN and the Anti-Defamation League. Tragically, this is not unique or rare. As we reported earlier this month, according to a recent study by UCLA's Williams Institute, 30% of LGBTQ youth who experience violence, such as bullying, attempt or complete a suicide. And here locally, according to the Bay Area Reporter, a gay man who served as mayor of Sebastopol and a longtime executive in the cannabis industry was arrested and charged with five felonies and one misdemeanor related to sexual assault with a minor. Robert Jacob, who is 44 years old, is being held without bond in the Sonoma County Main Detention Center, and he's accused of assaulting at least one underage victim. Police Chief Kevin Kilgore said the alleged assaults are believed to have occurred between December 2019 and March 2021. The chief said that police learned of the alleged sexual assaults on March 30th and launched an investigation, culminating with Jacob's arrest on April 10th. The arrest warrant alleges a number of offenses involving minors 16 years and younger. For a calendar of LGBT events happening here in the North Bay, go to gaysonoma.com. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. But I don't know
what to do. Chelsea Koenig is certainly a mover and shaker in our community and has now moved into a position as film programmer for the Alexander Valley Film Festival. Welcome back to the show, Chelsea.
Hi, thank you so much. It's good to be back, Gary.
What were you tasked with?
Well, I got involved. So I'm the chair of the board of directors at Positive Images, our LGBTQIA center in Sonoma County. And through that work, someone else on our board had a relationship with Catherine Hecht, who's the executive director of Alexander Valley Film Society. And Catherine had asked whether Positive Images might want to put together a panel for last year's festival in 2020 to accompany some trans documentaries that were being shown at the festival. And I got on the planning call, and Catherine and I got to talking. I was talking about reading Celluloid Closet, Vito Russo's book, and she was really excited about my knowledge and my enthusiasm for queer cinema, and really just, we really just clicked with regard to our passion and our interest in film and in film festivals. She's got a lot more experience than me, of course, in terms of creating a film festival and programming it. But I've done a bit of that work myself and a lot of work in event production. And so last year in 2020, I wound up booking a panel of trans activists from around the Bay Area to speak about the film Disclosure and a couple of films about Marsha P. Johnson. And they also put me on a panel, AVFF put me on a panel looking at one of Greg Araki's films, which has the F word in the title, so I won't say it, but totally effed up. And those were just really, really good experiences. And afterwards, Catherine brought up that she would love to be bringing on a few different programmers to expand kind of the vision and creative outlook on the fest. So this year, I came on to do an LGBTQIA film block, and Chris Metzler, who's a local filmmaker, came on to do like a Bay Area-focused Bay Area director's film block.
Excellent. Well, let's talk about some of the films. First off, tell us all about P.S. Burn This Letter, Please.
Oh, I'm so excited about this one. I'm excited about our entire lineup, but this particular film is so moving. I've only watched it once so far, but I've been like itching to just rewatch and rewatch it. It is a documentary that came out in late 2020 on the festival circuit and hasn't gotten wide release yet. It just feels so unlikely that this film could have come together as it did, but it's such a like gem of a document. So in 2014, a storage unit in Los Angeles was being cleaned. It belonged to a man who had gone by the name Reno Martin in his earlier life, and had been a radio producer by that name. So he died in 2010, and people were clearing out his storage unit and found a stash of 120 pages of letters that were written to him by his friends, who were all drag performers in the 1950s in New York City. And the directors were actually able to, they spent 5 years working on this project, but they were able to research and track down many of the subjects who had written these letters. And those of them who are still living are in their 80s and 90s. And so they interview, I think it's at least six people who wrote these letters about this time in their lives, which is, you know, pre-Stonewall by almost two decades, and just a facet of queer history and trans history that is so, so minimally seen. And getting to have these firsthand accounts is just incredible. All of the subjects are spread throughout the United States now, and don't seem to be in touch with each other. But I am extremely thrilled to share that one of the subjects in the film is a man who lives in Sonoma County. And so when I found that out, I asked the directors whether we might be able to interview him. So the program that we have for a Q&A around this is really special. It's going to be at 10 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, April 24th, right toward the beginning of our festival. It'll be an online Q&A. And I love that it's kind of at like a drag queen brunch hour. But I brought in one of my favorite drag performers locally, a performer who's probably around my age, named Mary Weiss. So Mary's a San Francisco drag queen, and they're going to be interviewing, moderating the Q&A with the two directors. And before that happens, I am going to be going over to Robbie's house. Robbie's the subject in Sonoma County, and helping him get set up on Zoom so that he can join us.
Wow, excellent. We tried to secure this for Outwatch, you know, over a year ago, but weren't able to. We all really loved it. It's a beautiful and really important film. Like you said, pre-Stonewall by 20 years. And just quite fascinating.
It's incredible. It's so moving. There's like so many moments in it that are really uplifting, but it's also, I think, a major, just an emotional experience to watch. So I laughed, I cried. It just feels exhilarating to have these histories being shared.
Absolutely. So talk about Tahara and why you've selected it to be part of this program.
Tahara is a really, really cool film. We ended up with a lot of documentaries in our lineup, but I'm really excited that we do have this program with a narrative feature, and then there's going to be two shorts along with it. So the director is named Olivia Peace, and their background is in animation and fine art. They're doing some kind of arts or games program actually at USC, I believe, right now. But they made this film, which is a coming of age story. The main character in it, her name is Carrie, and she is, it takes place at a synagogue after a funeral of a classmate. And it's a story about Carrie and her best friend, Hannah. And Carrie is a Black, queer, Jewish girl. So already it's really surprising and refreshing to see a character, like, those are not descriptors that you usually see on screen for a lead role. And it's really awesome. The actor, Madeline The actor who plays the lead is really phenomenal in the role. And her counterpart, Rachel Sennott, is also really excellent. There's really great performances in this film. Madeleine Gray DeFreeze, sorry about that, and Rachel Sennott. There are little bits of animation woven into the story, which is otherwise live action. And I described it as a sometimes tender film about the ruthlessness of adolescence. There's really some kind of punch in the gut moments as Carrie's character navigates just a really heart-wrenching coming out moment, but is nonetheless such a strong character in the film, and I think that people will really resonate with her.
Nice. Talk about the shorts that will be paired with it.
Yeah, so I mentioned that we partnered up with Petaluma Film Festival, and I was able to view the shorts that were submitted there, some of which had LGBTQIA themes. And there were two that really stood out to me. Tahara's a fairly short feature. It's under 80 minutes. And so this is winding up kind of being a long block because we've got two longer short films. XY is a coming-of-age story about a girl who is intersex. And what really stood out, this is a film from Iceland. And what really stood out to me about this film is how we actually, when watching this, get to see a character who comes out in a way to the people in her life, to a friend, and ends up sharing some information with her mother. And both of these people show support to her in a really, like, tender way that's kind of quiet and just good. Like, I don't want it to have to be, I don't want it to be applauded for people just reacting empathetically and with support. I want that to be the norm. But I think so many films that we do see about queer people, the rare films that exist about intersex people, about trans people, like anybody in the LGBTQIA community, so many of the narratives that are told even when we're supposed to, like, care about the LGBTQIA character, we're watching them experience just a lot of trauma and a lot of, like, bigoted views. And right. So there's a little bit of that in this film, but it's just so refreshing and moving to see characters reacting appropriately and showing love. And it's a really beautiful film in terms of cinematography and sound design and performances as well, of course. And then the other film in this block is called I Am Mackenzie. The director is from Greece, but was based in Texas at the time that she made the film. She did an MFA out of University of Texas at Austin. And so it takes place in Texas, and it's a trans story. And what I really love about this film is that it's not a trans narrative where you have somebody saying anything about coming out. He's certainly grappling with identity. The character Mackenzie is never given pronouns, but we learn that they are It's basically a story of this character who has a crush on their friend who is a cis boy, and there's a pretty intense like loss of virginity scene that entails one of the most like palpable depictions of gender dysphoria that I've ever seen on screen, in a way that is handled just really profoundly. So it's a heavy watch, but I think that it's important because I think viewers who have never experienced dysphoria actually get to like feel it when they watch the film. And I think it's also just a very fresh take on a trans narrative for this character.
Mm. You've selected Live Nude Girls Unite, which is a documentary from 20 years ago. Why is this film as important now as it was upon its initial release?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. So Live Nude Girls Unite is a Bay Area film. It was a fairly low-budget documentary made in 2000, like you said. And so I guess I want to say two things. It is about the unionization effort of strippers at the Lusty Lady, which was a strip club in San Francisco that has since closed, but it didn't close until like 2013. So this unionization effort took place in the late 90s and was largely successful, marking the first time that a strip club did unionize and sparking, it's even in the film, sparking other unionization efforts by strippers throughout the country. And so one thing that I want to touch on first is just to say, with a social justice theme or lens on the film festival, sometimes fests run into a problem where they have awesome content, but it's like overall pretty depressing. And I know that at times, I think in 2020, Alexander Valley had gotten that feedback. So one of the goals that we had this year was really to keep that lens, but create a program that also had a lot of like uplift and humor in it. And so Live Nude Girls Unite is a treasure for being like really funny and educational and serious all at the same time. The main like character in this nonfiction story is the director. It's a like biographical documentary, and at the time she was a stand-up comedian and a stripper at the Lusty Lady. She's also an activist, of course, doing this unionizing effort, and she's a lesbian. A lot of the people who worked at Lusty Lady are lesbian or are queer, and so that's why it fits into this block and is prominent in the festival. But I would say that it's extremely relevant today because sex workers' rights remain a topic, remain something that people are still very actively fighting for. And there's actually been pretty recent, in the last, 3 years, I would say, since 2018, when some laws called FOSTA-SESTA passed that had a really negative impact on people doing sex work on the internet. There has been big momentum around sex workers' rights organizing, and I think it's kind of broken into mainstream news, maybe more than it ever has before. So particularly with COVID, certain types of sex work are not legal and certain types are legal, like stripping, but even people doing legal forms of sex work were really impacted by the pandemic and being unable to work and were ineligible for a lot of the relief that other people doing other types of work were able to receive. And then additionally, there's so many myriad angles. I would say most sex workers and sex workers' rights activists are seeking not legalization, but decriminalization. So I think there's just, despite it breaking into the mainstream a little bit, there's still a lot of stigma around sex work, a lot of invisibility for these rights movements. And I think being able to recenter this film, bring it into the spotlight again, and then pair it with a Q&A that will be with the director as well as some activists working today about where some of these fights for justice are at is highly relevant to 2021.
It's a great film. I mean, it's funny, you know, I lived in the city when this was unfolding, and it was a big deal. I mean, it was covered really well in the sort of local press and the queer press. You know, of course, there are lots of queer people who work in the sex industry in various mm-hmm. ways. But it just strikes me that, you know, 20 years on, the fight continues, right? Not really all that much has changed, and it's possibly gotten worse for sex workers.
Yeah, absolutely. There's like, you know, one step forward, two steps back sort of thing. But there's so many people working really hard to amplify the injustices that sex workers face, and so much to talk about. I don't even know how we're going to cover much in an hour, but I'm excited to see where we get in that conversation.
Nice. And you'll have the filmmaker, just the filmmaker, or will there be others in the discussion?
We will have the filmmaker, and then there will probably be two other panelists. One of them will be from St. James Infirmary, which is a healthcare clinic in San Francisco that is the first in the nation that is run by, like, it is by and for sex workers, everything that they do. And so they really are on the ground every day doing activism for sex workers in 2021. And we're still figuring out the third person who will be a part of that conversation, but it's going to be great. It's going to be really kind of looking with Julia and with people working today on this at the past and at the present in terms of unionization fights as well as other fights for the rights of sex workers. Mm.
And last but certainly not least, tell us about Keyboard Fantasies, the Beverly Glenn Copeland story.
Keyboard Fantasies is a really cool, really like gentle film, I want to say, that looks at the life of a Black trans musician who goes by the name Glenn Copeland. His music is published under what I assume is his full legal name, Beverly Glenn Copeland. And Glenn has just this fascinating life. He grew up in Philadelphia, and then he went to McGill University in Canada. He made some albums that were really genre-defying and just extremely ahead of their time. Starting in the late 60s, and what is considered his masterpiece was called Keyboard Fantasies, and it's an album that he made in 1986. And I think he pressed like 200 copies of this album. It was just next to nothing. People did not understand his music. It was kind of at the intersection of like folk and jazz and experimental early like computer sounds and electronica with a big kind of new age thrust to it. And so he made just a couple of hundreds of copies of this. It did not go anywhere until in recent times, just a few years ago, some popular musicians of today, like hip musicians who are interested in some of his sounds, found it. And suddenly he was getting emails from people in Japan wanting to like sell everything that he had, every copy that he had, and they re-released it. And he is going on, I mean, this was all pre-COVID, the movie was made in 2019, but he's a touring musician in his mid-70s and his band is 20-somethings, and he just fits in with them perfectly. It's like he should have been born 50 years after he was. Glenn transitioned when he was in his 50s in the early 2000s. And so it's really just a portrait of this, like, man who has had a tremendously fascinating and kind of idiosyncratic life and where he's at now, as well as, like, his sort of philosophy of life. He talks about his race and class and gender, his spirituality. And then we get to just see him performing and see these friendships that he's developed with these people who are 50 years younger than him.
Yeah, it's a wonderful film. It's another film that I've seen and was just enchanted by such a sort of moving portrait of an artist, you know, who also happens to be trans, you know, which, you know, I think the film expertly sort of focuses on the work and the discovery of, you know, after decades of this incredible body of work.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very kind of, there are times where it feels sort of like an audio collage or has these like kind of new age music video elements to it. The direction is really nice on it. And it definitely, yeah, I think Glenn being trans is just one fact about his life. So it's definitely a part of the film, but we get the whole picture of who Glenn is, and his transness and his experience pre-transition, being perceived as a gender non-conforming queer person in the world. You know, all of that is there, but it's just one piece of who he is.
Yes. So how can folks watch all these great films, as well as the many other features, docs, and programs and discussions that will be part of AVFF?
I would love to tell you about that, but I do just want to take a moment because I think that you're humble and may not prompt the question. You mentioned that you've watched a lot of these films, and I do just want to shout out that Outwatch and your work with them has been a really helpful guide, and your friendship and guidance with this festival and the work that Outwatch does in Sonoma County is just tremendous, and I'm so grateful to be friends with you and Chad and Jody, as well as to have received your support in developing this lineup.
Oh, thank you, and you're most welcome.
So as far as watching these films, the Alexander Valley Film Festival is streaming April 23rd through May 2nd online. There are a couple of drive-in events that happen in person, but they don't relate to the films we just talked about. So if all you want to do is watch the online films, individual tickets, which do come with a pass to view any related Q&As or panels, those are $15. If you want a streaming pass to view everything virtual that is happening, that's $99. If you just want to see the shorts in the festival, that you can do a shorts pass for $39. If you're a student, there's a pass for $19. And then if you also want to go to those drive-in events, the like all-access pass is $139. But I will say that Alexander Valley Film Society really wants people to be able to see these films. So if any of those feel truly like a barrier to access, you can also just get in touch. You can get in touch with me or with the festival itself. My email is my name, chelsea.kernick@avfilmsociety.org. So chelsea.kernick@avfilmsociety.org. And the website is avfilmsociety.org, which is where all of this information is listed. All of the films and descriptions and trailers are up now, and we should be posting kind of descriptions of specifically the film block that I booked and when these Q&As are going to take place across those weeks by this weekend.
Chelsea, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and thank you for all the work you do for the community, and best of luck with the festival.
Thank you, Gary. It was such a pleasure to be on your show.
On air, online, or on the go, you're listening to Radio 91, 91.1 KRFB-FM Windsor, and 90.9 K215CQ Santa Rosa. Jane Winslow is co-director and festival manager of the Sebastopol Documentary Film Festival, as well as an educator and filmmaker herself. Welcome back to the show, Jane.
Thank you for having me, Gary. I appreciate being on.
Great. Well, first talk about your position at SDFF.
Well, I've been co-director for quite a few years with Jean McLaughlin and Cynthia Stefanoni. But this year, I've also taken on a festival manager position as well, which is a bit of herding cats and anything else that needs to be herded at the time. And we have a really, after having to pivot a couple weeks before going live last year and figuring out how to do docs make house calls throughout about a 6-7 month period. This year, even though we pushed it to June, our festival ended up, because of the virus, needing to stay virtual, which we're sorry about. Next year, we're going back to March, and we're for our festival time, and we are looking forward to bringing filmmakers and audiences back to live films. But here we're doing all virtual, but really we have 41 programs to offer, whether it's a shorts program or feature and short or a feature. And we have 5 very interesting panels / conversations to round out offerings, and I'm very excited about the program we're putting forward this year.
That's excellent. So did you see a significant drop off in your audience last year, and if so, what are you doing to sort of combat that this year?
Well, last year, since we did pivot, it was just seriously different, because it was we offered 2 kind of blocks per month, and had a lot less of our program offer because of that, and the way, you know, that we typically offer a huge amount of venues, whether it's at the Rialto or at the Festival Center for the Arts. And so now all of a sudden, you know, we had you know, we had a lot going on work-wise and presentation-wise, but it was just a completely different animal. So this year, we are, even though we're still virtual, we are relegating it to a Thursday through Sunday, the 4-day like we usually do. And then the 5 panel/conversations will be available starting on June 10th, but will go end of the month, so people can buy their tickets and watch film or pass. I'm happy if they buy passes too. But they can watch the films throughout the 4-day weekend, and then a little bit into the week, if you click on watch, then you have a few days to make sure to watch it. So you'll have a little extra time to watch films, but then you'll be able to watch the panels and discussion, 5 of them, all the way to the end of the month. So you have some time to see that. So we're trying to do it in a way that feels like a festival, and we are riffing off of many of our counterparts, festivals that are all trying to figure out the best way to proceed in this year that we thought we'd be free of all the parameters that we're dealing with. But of course, we aren't free of the parameters here. So we're trying to kind of find the sweet spot of being able to offer these incredible and experiences and give you access to the filmmakers through conversations and Q&As that we will be presenting and probably up on our website after the fact we did with our last year presentations. You can go onto our site and see some of our filmmakers from last year doing a Q&A about different their different subjects. But we're really trying to figure out kind of the best way to give a virtual experience on a small screen when we really, really get to the big screen.
Yes. So, I mean, SDFF is sort of known for really focusing on filmmakers. So are you really making the extra effort to have Q&As after most every film presentation or program?
Well, we can't do that because with 41 programs, that's quite a bit of after-the-fact Q&A. And the way we're releasing the films is as of 12:01 a.m. Thursday all the way to 11:59 p.m. on Sunday, the films are available. So we're just blanket releasing them. But we are targeting quite a few of Q&As. We have a film called Hunger Ward that is a film that is up for short subject documentary Oscar. And you saw him, I think it was the year before last. It's an award-winning doc called Lifeboat, and it was also up for an Academy Award. And he's back with the award, and we're going to Q&A with him, and he's in a block where his short and another short called Sustained Outrage, we're going to have a Q&A after it, and for sure, we'll have Sky on that, the filmmaker who did Hunger Ward, and we're going to try to have some folks either from Sustained Outrage or other small newspapers on and have a discussion of that, the issue of getting the news out. And we're also going to have a panel of local journalism kind of on the brink. What are we doing with our local newspapers, and where is news going to really continue coming from? So we should have some very interesting discussions out there. And I'll be talking with a filmmaker from Sydney, Australia. And we're doing a conversation / panel on documentary styles and trying to expand people's understanding of documentary style, documentary elements that we use to tell a nonfiction story, but with kind of elements that are sometimes perceived as not a true documentary, which to me, I think sometimes our audiences kind of confuse news of style with the only way to tell a nonfiction story, versus there are a lot of other ways of telling a nonfiction story, a documentary, using elements of reenactments or dance or movement or a whole bucket full of different style techniques that we can use within the document structures. So that film I'll talk a little bit about, since even though it's not an Outwatch offering, it's an offering that talks about Russia filmmakers in the 1920s, 1920 that are doing all this work, and it's women filmmakers in that era that get documented, and in, you know, some very leaning towards lesbian feel to it. So it's a short that is worthy of seeing in and of itself, and also to come and take a look at this conversation I'm going to have with Karen Perlman about documentary style. So those are two offerings that are going to be very interesting to kind of wrap your head around.
There you go. So so have you noticed some sort of trends in the films that were submitted to you and that you've selected? You know, what's sort of new and exciting in the documentary film category, if you will?
Well, we are lucky in that we promote a lot of variety of styles, and we have a lot of nonfiction animation. So as far as it was kind of an interesting year because we had over 650 up from 430 the year before. We
had wow.
that many submissions, which I have to give a shout out to our screeners who are first line folks who take a look, and we have at least 4 to 5 people review every film that comes in. So that's, they watched a whole lot of films for us, and kudos to every single one of them that take their time and watch a real large amount of films. And our quality, I was surprised to talk to other festivals around the country that had some drop off in submissions, and we had just absolutely the opposite. Though we are an Academy Award shorts nominating festival, we've gotten that designated, and so that does make us even more kind of front and center in many ways. But I was surprised. There were quite a few, of course, pandemic lockdown documentaries, some absolutely ones. We have one that's called Wuhan Wuhan that we were very lucky to get that documents the of a period of time and a group of different selected people in Wuhan during the height of their epidemic, and it's a beautifully made documentary. I mean, just really. But it's not kind of as heavy as you would think on that subject matter. It was a surprise to me. I think people really, it takes a lot to make a bloody documentary. I'm sure we will see more and more and more of the pandemic documentaries in years to come. But we had quite a few, and we have quite a few in our program of Black Lives Matter and race issues, since that is front and center as well in our lives. So as far as one thematic piece for this year, we really didn't have as strong a kind of one direction or the other, except for those two are themes that you would, of course, get would bubble up at this period of time.
Yes. Let's talk about the films that SDFF is sort of co-presenting with Outwatch Film Festival. Just cover them all. Let's start maybe with the features.
Great. We got two features this year with the Outwatch designators. And the first one I will mention is Julia Spucky, Funny That Way. And it's by a producer-director, Susan Sandler. And about a comic who has been since the late 1980s appearing in comedy clubs across the country as Rick Scotty, and then realized at 47 that something just didn't feel right. And she is now a transgender comedian, Julia Scotti, and it's just a lovely documentary, and she's very funny, and I am sad that we don't have a live festival, because she was very anxious to come join us here in Sebastopol and regale us with some of her comedy, but unfortunately we are still in lockdown, so that is impossible. Jean, my co-director, had the idea of maybe having her descend into a park in a hot air balloon, which thrilled about the idea, but we decided against it, unfortunately, being so still locked down, at least during the planning stages. So it's a very beautifully done, very heartful documentary. I'm very excited to bring that to audiences, that you will laugh, of course, be touched. It's very tender and very, very moving to hear about Julia's progression. And then the other feature that we have is called A Sexplanation. And it's the adventures of 36-year-old Alex Liu, who's the director, who goes on a quest to kind of uncover the truths and the hard facts, as he calls them, of sex. And he's a gay man, and so he is, again, very fun, lighthearted, poignant journey from kind of, as he says, his shame-filled past to a happier, healthier future. And, you know, interviews with everything from neuroscientists to a Jesuit priest. So his parents are, so it's a very fun romp, I will call it, or quest, adventure, journey. So those are our two features for Outwatch. And then we have a bit of a long short. We have a 36-minute short called Unforgivable, which is this really, how they got access and how they made this film is one of those wonderful documentary stories that right. I'm sure in there. Because our main character is a ruthless hitman from a street gang who is sentenced to an El Salvadorian prison. And to quote the synopsis, in prison, it happens to be an evangelical church prison, and he cannot find forgiveness. He can find forgiveness more easily from being a hitman and from killing people than he can feel forgiven by being gay. And it is such an exquisite film, really. It is, again, an amazing insight into what it is like to be gay in an El Salvadorian prison and the journey this gang member goes through. It's a exquisite film, and it should be up for an Academy Award as well, but I think it was, might have been listed, not 100% sure, but boy, it should be.
Yeah, they missed the boat on that one.
I'm blown away by how good that film is. And then we have one is called Girls Boys Mix. And it's about an intersex 9-year-old who very candidly kind of describes and tries to reveal how it is to be intersex. aspects and not necessarily feeling the need to, you know, which one she is, just be gender binary. And, but of course, then, you know, how does the rest of the world react to that? So very sweet, beautiful. I don't even know. I think I shouldn't call it sweet. It's just a real beautiful film, mm-hmm. beautifully made, beautiful to look at, playful. Oh, my goodness. The lead character, Gwen, is just a delightful young upstart and just beautiful. And have one one we have yet another Dean Hammer film who boy, he's, I can't even remember, there's so many. Do you remember how many different ones we've had over the years of Dean Hammer?
It seems 4 or 5, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he's such a really wonderful filmmaker, and he has an animated short or mini, a 9-minuter, and he has two other co-directors, Joe Wilson and Wong Kalu. And anyway, this animated piece is fascinating, and again, beautiful and really exquisite. Very vivid. It's a discussion. It's a legendary transgender healing spirits, and kind of in the history of, I believe they came from Tahiti to Hawaii, and there are 4 stones on Waikiki Beach that are imbued with this healing spirit. And that they've been kind of, you know, ignored for years. And so they tell the story about these boulders and kind of how it came about. And it's in the ancient Hawaiian dialect. It's a beautiful film. And I'm probably going to blur the pronunciation of the name. So I'm going to go slow. Kapamahu is the name of this film. So those are our Outwatch offerings this year.
Yeah, and they're all knockouts, truly. I mean, in their own way. Like you said, beautiful, you know, poignant, you know, devastating in some regards, and but all fascinating stories.
I mean, quality of filmmakers, you know, it's just really mind-blowing. Actually, it seems like every year we get these, and the director, amazing people. They tell their story with, you know, authenticity and heart, but craft wise, they're excellent films, just beautiful.
Nice. We're running a little low on time, but let's talk about the panel discussion that you and I will be doing.
Great. So do you want to run with it, Gary, or do you want me to?
No, you go ahead. Go ahead. You're the guest.
Okay. Well, you and I are still putting some final tweaks on it, but we have a very, I think it's from what I talked to when I talked to friends about it, a very helpful discussion about not just kind of what are the big name LGBTQI films, but what are the documentaries that maybe have flown a little bit under the radar, or what are some of the documentaries by pretty famous director that might bear taking a look at, and that might not be their biggest named ones, but maybe are particularly yummy. So I think we're going to really have a fun and interesting discussion of the one documentary films that kind of explore the LGBT experience, and also that might not be on everybody's list, or that if they are on the list, really take a look at them. Even if you've seen them before, that stand the test of time.
Right. I mean, there's so many good ones out there, and there's so many, you know, currently in release and more to come, I'm sure. But we're looking forward to a nice discussion. Let our listeners know how they can get tickets and passes for the Sebastopol Documentary Film Festival.
Sure. We're releasing the passes, so you can buy your pass on May 1st. And that just gets you into every possible thing you want, including the five panels and conversations that will go to the end. And that goes set on sale on May 1st, and you can go to our website, sebdocs.org, and you'll get all the links and everything you want about getting a pass, a festival VIP passes. And then the single tickets and the five-pack, which gets you into any five of your choice. Those go on sale May 5th. So you can find out more information, as I said, by seb.org. And check out our website. We have, I just cut three new trailers for our festival, and very fun. I just love doing this every year because I love our dog, and I love the beautiful people and subjects that we are going to share. So come check it out.
Great. Jane, thank you so much for joining me tonight. Best of luck with the festival, and we'll see you out there.
Great, Gary. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for listening tonight, and please listen to Outbeat Radio every Sunday at 8 p.m. right here on KRCB. Greg Moralia will be here next week with Outbeat News in Depth. Hopefully, Mary and I will return to the studio for another Outbeat Collage on May 16th. Thank you for listening once again, and good night.